Welcome to Out to Lunch. So nice of you to join me as I take a famous person for a slap-up meal and we record the sparkling conversation. Today, I am joined by a stand-up comedian whose onstage character doesn't actually have a name, but he still filled arenas, presented his own TV shows, and even run for Parliament. When not playing his alter ego, my guest has a passion for military history, and he's also a hugely respected drummer who's played with Iron Maiden and Queen and even runs a leading company that makes them. Time, ladies and gentlemen, please, for the pub landlord, Al Murray.
Don't want to play Hamlet or any of that comedian stuff.
Don't think it's going to happen, mate. But
No, it's far too late for that. Well, they didn't Ian McKellen play in recently. I mean, maybe there's a...
Yeah, but he had quite a good form.
I'm standing by the Grand Union Canal, not far from Paddington Station, by a barge, which is also a restaurant. It's the London Shell Company's Grand Duchess, which is a floating restaurant. One of theirs actually goes up and down the canal, and you can have a sort of floating dinner. This one stays put. I reviewed it a few years ago. Lovely, lovely fish dishes. Al Murray just loves his food. I mean, he's a big restaurant goer, and I think he's going to like this. We have the whole place to ourselves with the waters floating past us. It's going to be a delight.
Hello there. Hi. Wow. Ow. Special. Hello, Jay.
Welcome.
Thanks.
Very good to see you.
Likewise, yes.
Have a seat.
Oh, this is very convivial.
Isn't it?
Have a place to yourself.
I want to tell you, this bowl of chipsticks looked like this the moment it arrived, but actually it was heaped. And I think,
you've been at them. You've been at them, have you?
Well, look at chipsticks.
Yeah, look at that. That's
look at them.
Good,
they have to be done.
Still
this is Eliza who will be serving
nice
us.
Nice to meet you.
I have to thank you on the record.
Yep.
Because 16 years ago, I have mentioned this to you before, yeah. We do know each other slightly. Mm, mm. 16 years ago, you gifted me the perfect opener for every after-dinner, after-lunch speech I've ever done. I don't know if you remember this.
No.
All right.
Remind me.
We were both guests at Gordon Ramsay's 40th birthday party.
Oh, dear God.
Do you remember it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, my memory is exactly as you would expect the birthday party of a superstar chef to be.
Yep.
Hugely decadent.
Yep.
It was in the old war rooms, I think. Cabinet office on Whitehall somewhere.
It was in Whitehall. Yes, yeah. It was, wasn't it? Yeah.
And there was human sculptures draped in food. There was
yep.
a performance by the cast of Chicago stage.
Yeah.
And?
Yes, I did a turn. Yeah.
Because you've been on Hell's Kitchen, haven't you?
That's right. I did the first series of Hell's Kitchen with Gordon, which I enjoyed enormously. I had a whale of a time doing that, even though it was not my usual environment in any... I'm not interested in anyone really knowing about me very much. I want to be a comedian. I want my comedy to do the sort of lifting. But I really enjoyed it. So I really enjoyed being around the chefs and I really enjoyed learning and
didn't you?
All that
you,
stuff.
You progressed quite far in the competition.
Yeah, I got to the last Friday, yeah.
Right. Anyway, so you're in Gordon doing it a bit as,
as
the pub landlord and you're going around the audience saying, who are you? And you point at me and you say, you mate, what do you do? And I said, I'm a restaurant critic. And you replied, fat bloke, what types?
Well,
you are there, Al, laughing at one of your own jokes.
Yes. Yes. But, you know, I can see that in the moment that would have worked, which is how it always goes.
And now I tell this story at the beginning of every speech I ever do.
Really?
And he described me as fat bloke, what types? And then I go, which was quite shocking because I think of myself as a journalist. No. And then I can tell my story. So I think you know, that a good opener... is comedy gold.
It's everything. Yeah, absolutely. The show I'm doing at the moment, I've got four things I come on and I do without fail. Not necessarily the same order, but out they come and we're up, we're set, we're going, and then we can go.
Isn't the first job of a comedian, in fact, any performer, to put the audience at their ease to know that everything's going to be okay?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, and I'm really fortunate because people know what to expect from me, but that means you have to come on and give them what they expect. People talk about comedy, secret to comedy being surprise, and I always think that's not actually the case. I think it's about trust. You can surprise people within the way they trust you. You know, you're not just a jack in the box.
But if you put it up 20, 25, I don't know what your ticket price is these days, £75 to see you on stage, they want the thing that they paid their money for.
Absolutely. You know, I'm quite comfortable with doing the jokes. Not doing old jokes they want to hear, but giving them the thing, in sort of red-blooded form.
Well, with a segue worthy of 1980s Radio 1, I'm very keen on giving you what you want. So should we have a look at the menu?
Yes, please, yeah.
So it's well, I can say essentially it's fish-based.
Well, you know what? My wife and I have tried to get in here.
Have you?
Yep, and have failed. Because if I'm around, we try and eat properly. And we've had our sights set on here and not got here. So this is very exciting.
Well, now you're here.
Yeah.
In fact, a little bit like, is it the De Niro figure in Once Upon a Time in America? I booked the whole place for you.
No, it's beautiful.
Although that ends really darkly, so let's not go there. The fish platter, is that a sharing thing?
Yeah, sharing starter. So between the two of you, we've got the smoked salmon, pepper trout, crevettes. Also have cold, but lovely to pick on and share.
So that is an option, or we can do a couple of starters and a couple of mains. What do you want to do?
You had me at, is that to share? Fish platters to share, right. You know, that's what life's all about.
So let's have a fish platter, and then what do you want to... You get first dibs on the mains.
Okay. Could I have the trout, please?
You want to go for the drumstring trout?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And I'll have the place, please.
You're going to go for the place?
And it would obviously be illegal not to have the chips, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we've got to have the chips.
We'll get it done. Anything to drink for you, gents?
Glass of wine?
I can have a glass of wine.
Glass of whites of some kind?
A white wine, yeah. A glass of white wine, thank you.
I've got a lovely white burgundy on at the moment. We'll get you a couple of glasses of that.
Yeah,
why not?
That'd be
brilliant.
Perfect.
Thank you.
The origins of the pub landlord. Remind us how that character came to be.
The character is an accident. He was meant to get me through that evening. I was doing stuff with Harry Hill, who I'd met on Weekending, which some people may remember as the Radio 4 topical satire show. I met Harry at that. We became friends. And we were doing a show in Edinburgh where we had a little band, me and a fellow called Matt Bradstock, who sadly is no longer with us, who played the keyboards. I played the drums. Harry sang. And we got all the way to Edinburgh with me saying, I'm going to come up with a thing to link it all together, to compare it. Harry, you do your stand-up. They did stuff together and we'd finish with the band. And I said, I'll come up with a linking thing. And the thing I came up with didn't work. And so when we got to the opening night in Edinburgh, we were in the cabaret bar at the Pleasance, that people may know if they go to the Fringe. And I said, well, why don't... Just before we were about to... You know, we've done our sound check. Yeah. We're back in the dressing room. I said, well, why don't we say that the compere didn't show up and the barman has offered to fill in? And Harry was sort of like, yeah, whatever, another one of your bright ideas. And that's what... So I scribbled some things down and I went on and did the things I'd written
down.
What
were you wearing?
To play the pub band drummer, I had a sort of double-breasted suit and a roll neck. Sort of, you know, run down... Thank you very much.
You.
Cheers. A run-down London pub was the idea I was going for. Mainly because doing the comedy circuit, the cabaret circuit, you went to a lot of run-down London pubs as a comic, so it felt like it fit. Anyway, so I went on and I did the stuff, and it worked. I introduced Harry. Harry went on. During his 40 minutes, I wrote... You know, five more things in the sort of desperate deadline clinch. And I'm a deadline person. And those worked. And then,
And 65 years on.
It's a bit like that. Dame Edna, after all.
Yeah.
Was invented as a bit for the Commonwealth Games in 1956 by Barry Humphreys. So, and I don't imagine he thought that, again, you know, 900 years later, he'd still be doing it. I kind of think it's in that spirit. But he never had the pub landlord ever name. He never had a pub.
I started trying to look this up.
Yeah.
The backstory for the pub landlord, what is his name beyond Gov?
Well, the idea sort of became quite quickly that it's raining and you go in a pub to get out the rain and you don't know the name of the pub. It's not where you would ever drink. And you've gone in and the barman says, who are you? What are you doing in here? What do you do? Starts at you and you don't get time to know him or him... tell you about himself. A backstory has sort of evolved over the years because I've had to write one for things where they want one, But I never said.
Did you find that quite annoying when they asked you for a backstory?
Yeah, well, yes and no. But I also think, you know, he's a drunk, so his backstory is entirely unreliable.
So it can change.
So it does change. You know, the names of his dogs change. And
what have they been over the years?
It was Gary for quite a while. There's a dog called Gary. And then there's a dog called Ramrod. I'm a fan of the idea of the unreliable witness. I think comedians ought to be unreliable witnesses anyway.
I've watched a load of stuff prior to us meeting over lunch.
God help you.
The one that really struck me was the how finance works.
Yes.
Which is pure pub landlord, but also quite instructive.
Well, that's...
It's like you are actually explaining what goes on in the city.
Yes, I've ended up doing some routines like that. There was one about a European bank I used to do as well, which really upset people in the end, because what I'd do is I'm going to explain how a European bank works to you, but I'm going to need change. So I basically took change off the whole of the front row, put it in my pocket, and I said, and that's where that explanation ends. And there was one night where a guy, he gave me a £50 note, right?
You couldn't now give it back, could you?
No, no, so I didn't, right? And then we get all these, you know, basically green ink letters to the theatre and then to my management and all this sort of thing. He stole 50 quid off me. And I did used to say, give me your small change, you know, give me your loose, not your folding, you know, whatever you do. Well, I remember there was a great night. It was at Warwick Arts Centre where me and my tour manager, and he got his brother in to help, where we cashed up this sort of giant bag of money, you know, like, and we gave it to, you know, obviously gave it to charity, but it was...
You'd like to put that on the record.
And it's on the record now. But yes, that's exactly what we did. But yes, I mean, I always think those routines where maybe you're explaining a thing, but also you're being in character. They're the ones that are fun to do. Wonderful. Look at that.
There we go. So our fish platter here for you. Crevettes, smoked salmon, pepper trout, some cod's roe.
I'll do it that way around.
So that we're not as messy.
Enjoy. Brilliant.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. The key one, because it was the longest piece of material, was the 2015 election.
Yes.
Where you ran in Thanet South.
Yes.
For the Free United Kingdom
Party. Yes, FUKP. Yes.
FUKP. It was the great seriousness with which you took the comedy of standing as a ridiculous character. Some people criticised you for undermining politics.
I know, right? Wonderful. Yeah.
Whereas it seemed to me that you were doing the exact opposite, weren't you?
Part of it was a friend in a pub said, are you going to run in the general election next year?
Well, that was just off the top of the head.
Well, no, because the show I was touring at the time... Was the landlord saying, right, I can do politics. We were coming to the end of that of coalition government, and comedians were becoming much more political.
Did you feel you were being left behind and had to get into that?
No. Quite the opposite, actually.
Oh, right.
I was quite worried that people were going there, because I think, as a comic, in the end, you mustn't pick a side. You've got to be able to land your blows on left or right, and middle, and top and bottom.
Just as long as it's funny.
As long as it's funny. It looked like a trap at the time. And then Russell Brand pops up, having, I think, fallen completely into the trap and is suddenly an expert on politics and talking about politics, and said that you shouldn't vote because it doesn't change anything. Which, of course, you know, in the preceding 7 years since then, he has been proved so spectacularly technicolor wrong. So I thought, well, I haven't got Russell's platform, but what I can do is I can get involved. You know, there's no better way than telling people to vote than asking them to vote for you, to then think to themselves, well, I'm not going to vote for him because it's ridiculous. Which was the plan in Thanet. We didn't want anyone to vote for me at all, but we wanted them to vote.
You must have been distressed by the 318 people who did vote for you.
I have since met people in Margate who claimed to have voted for me, so. Which is sweet of them, but also, you know, there was no need for that, old boy. I mean, this trout is amazing.
It is very good, isn't it?
I mean...
7 years on from that, has it changed the way that you view political discourse in this country?
Well, I came out... Yes, I came out with sort of two conclusions. One is who'd be a politician. Everyone is basically desperate for you to fail. Your allies are desperate for you to fail so they can climb over your corpse and all that. So who'd do it? Which means you've got to ask who's doing it.
Right.
You know, so much of our discourse has been really shattered and disrupted by the last 20 years, really. Coming out of the Iraq war, where, you know, people's faith in a government telling them the truth about something really important sort of fatally undermined. And I think, you know, that, and I know there were plenty of reasons why that happened, but I think that's some of the consequence. And then, you know, you're trying to use David Cameron's conviction that using referenda to solve problems was a good one was...
Have you talked to your first cousin about this?
Oh, God. We're going to have to explain what that means.
Yeah, go on, go on, go on.
Hello, it's Ollie here. I'm the executive producer on Out to Lunch. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, one of the relationships I'm proudest of in my life is with my daughters. They're not quite the age to go for fancy lunches with celebs yet, but we do enjoy our family dinners together in relative harmony. You know, give us time, that they are still quite young. But this takes work, and it's a mistake to think that relationships have to be easy to be right. The best relationships come out of learning to live with each other and keeping our sense of humour, even when food is spilt all over the table or dinner's not to everyone's liking. It can be really tricky, but therapy can help you with those skills. You can work through parenting challenges, explore seeing eye to eye as a couple, and work through your relationship with yourself too. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's flexible and you can switch therapists at any time, as that's a relationship that needs to be the right fit too. Become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/outtolunch today and get 10% off your first month.
Hello, it's me, Jamie Lang, and I've got a new podcast, and this time there are no gimmicks. It's just great company. Because the thing is, I realize the reason I love podcasts so much is because they're a great way to connect with people.
Hello, I'm Youngblood.
Joe Brand.
I'm Paloma Faith.
Jay Blades.
Elizabeth Day.
Zara Larson.
Casper Lee.
And I'm Great Company.
Great Company.
Great Company.
Great Company.
Apparently.
It's Great Company with me, Jamie Lang. Coming Wednesday, the 27th of March.
Well, so what was really wonderful? What was really wonderful about the, I mean, and it's sort of a precursor of where we are now, really. It's during the 2015 campaign, conspiracy theories started to surface as to why I might have done it, and there are several. Because if you go on my Wikipedia,
a dangerous place.
A dangerous place, of course. You'll get this impression that that I'm a sort of twirling cane toff, and all this sort of stuff. My grandfather was the ambassador to Greece. He was governor of the BBC.
Your great-great-grandfather was...
Three great-grandfathers, William Thackeray. That's on my mother's side. But that doesn't mean he was posh. That means he was a... They were an East India Company family. He had money, and he was a novelist.
But you've been eminently downwardly mobile as a family for decades.
Well, this
you?
Is how I this is how I feel about it. And every now and again, I get a sort of, like, kind of Corbynite class warrior going, you know, I think, aren't I going in the right direction? Is this what you want? My grandmother, I mean, my grandmother, my father's mother, was from an Austrian. Her father was a count, I think, but then they abolished counts when the First World War ended because they were told they had to, you know, get rid of the Austro-Hungarian. So she wasn't a countess. So she, you know, so we're headed in the right direction. So there was all these conspiracy theories, and I remember having amazingly
for the last piece of trout. Floor. I know you want to.
It's so delicious.
Yeah,
amazingly on. Fruitless argument with someone on Twitter who went. He's going, your grandfather, he fixed it for you to do well in comedy. And I'm thinking, right, well, he died when I was 14, long before I knew what I wanted to do. And also, how? Is there someone at the Foreign Office who was ringing round pubs in the mid-90s to make sure I got work?
Had jongleurs on
exactly jongleurs on speed dial because we had in his Filofax on speed dial. Like,
the references
exactly. These are the times we're talking
speed
about
speed dial
exactly. Exactly. They were carbon dating ourselves quite successfully there. But and the guy's going, yeah, that's how it works for you people. And I'm thinking, fuck, what are you on about? The other conspiracy that then surfaced was, and it's because of Thackeray, who was my great 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 grandfather.
Wrote Vanity Fair.
Vanity Fair, Penn Dennis. Barry Lydon wrote for Punch. I've got his Mr. Punch inkwell that they gave him when he left.
Oh, really?
And there's a genealogy website, or there was, and what they do kind of every 18 months is they do a press release where they say, look, you know, Princess Diana is related to Barack Obama, and you can find this stuff out too. This is how far down the barrel they'd got, is they'd found that a relative of four generations ago relative of David Cameron's, had married a four generations ago relative of mine. Neither is the product of that union, but that if you leave that to simmer...
Didn't you say 800,000 people could also have had that connection?
Well, we're all, you know, we're all like Danny Dyer. We're all related to Edward II or God, whoever. Yeah, exactly. You know, Charlemagne, isn't it? But you leave that to simmer on an aggrieved message board, and it turns into him and me being first cousins. And that's why I did it, because either the EU put me up to it via the BBC, which was a very strong theory. And given my relationship with the BBC, which is very on and off, and they've never held me to their bosom. I've never been, it's like the mafia. I'm not a captain in the, you know, I've occasionally done a couple of murders for them.
That's about it.
Yeah, exactly. So it turned into, he's my first cousin. I've done it for him to help the Tories out in the constituency, which is sort of completely mental.
Ever met Dave?
I met him twice, yeah. Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Did we discuss the family?
No, we didn't. We didn't say, you know, how the kids, you know, mission accomplished, none of that. I've met him at two events, yeah. At the time, I was kind of fascinated and entertained by the way that people were seeing this. But now, I realise this is how people see the world. And I find that quite worrying.
It is. It is bizarre. We have food arriving.
Oh, look at that.
We've got chips. Here we have our chalk stream trout with lentils, oyster mushrooms, salsa verde.
Wow.
And your place with peri, clams and curly kale.
Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you so much. Some mayonnaise. Those need mayonnaise.
Yeah, wonderful.
They are sexy looking chips.
They
you
are.
We are Facebook friends.
Mm.
You might, if you're listening to this, have a vision of what you think Al Murray's Facebook page is going to look like. What it is an awful lot of drums.
Yes.
If anybody didn't know what you did for a living, they would assume that you were full-time a professional drummer, which up to a point you almost are.
They might think that, yeah. Yeah, I almost.
I'm not going to go back into the comedy, but when you initially went at Oxford down to a rehearsal room to drum, that was where you met Stuart Lee and Richard Herring.
Yeah, absolutely. Sat at the piano were Stuart Lee and Richard Herring, who had just been in Edinburgh and had just done a review with their... They had a review group called the Seven Raymonds, and there were five of them, which was... That was the joke, right?
It's quite a good game.
It's not bad. It's good enough. You're clearly young prospects there, worth pursuing. And they were like, oh, I said, what are you doing? You know, and they were, we're putting a skit show together. You know, Stu were putting a skit show together, and Rich all like chipper. And I said, what's the comedy scene here? And they told me, and that then meant I went the Sunday after to the club where you could do new stuff.
Let's be absolutely clear. You played, however that has come about, with some very significant people. You played with Iron Maiden, haven't you?
Yeah.
You played
Queen.
With Queen.
Yeah.
How did those gigs happen?
You duetted with Phil Collins.
How did you duet with Phil Collins?
There was a drumming magazine, and I became friends with the people on that. Sometimes I'd write him 800 words in a hurry about which drummers to listen to, that sort of thing. And it's 20 years ago now. I was asked to front a clinic tour, as it's called, with a guy called Steve White, who was Paul Weller's drummer for a really long time, and he's a maestro. He's sort of Stradivarius, you know. And Chad Smith from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and they're great friends. And Chad came over, and they did a drumming tour. We went all around the country. They played.
And you were emceeing it.
And I was emceeing it because they didn't want to talk. So I'd come on and go, "Hello, everybody." I'd be relaxed with it, and I was paid in drums at the end of this.
Were you very happy?
I was extremely happy. Although it was also that thing of Stuart Copeland used to talk about when...
Drummer with the Police.
Yeah, the drummer with the Police. You spend a chunk of your time wishing for stuff and then they start giving it to you and the kind of shine goes off it. But anyway, I got given a drum set and gained a relationship with all these players and with this British drum company called Premier, and we became part of my sort of circuit. And I've made lots of great friends, and I know all sorts of people who played on amazing records and also who are just like, they're out there all the time playing. And
they take you very seriously, though.
They seem to, but that's really because of the drum company that I founded.
The British Drum Company is a proper drum manufacturing company making very pretty drums.
Handmade in England. But the Royal Marines are playing our drums. Most of the drums at the Queen's funeral were our drums, even though, you know, they were all covered in black, and so you could hear the our marketing people thinking, this is a triumph, but bugger.
Because the last thing you can do, if it organically happened that everybody noticed, that would be fine, but you can't go.
No, you cannot blow that particular trumpet. No, so Nico and Iron Maiden plays our drums, Ian and Kasabian plays our drums, Bastille, Blossoms, Pete Cater, who's a big band drummer, plays our jazz drums.
Did you ever see the episode of the Rolling Stones doc series on Charlie Watts?
No.
Because it turned out that what Charlie Watts, who we all know was the accidental drummer in a rock band because he was a jazz drummer.
Yeah.
He spent his money collecting every drum kit that ever came up for sale from any great name.
Yeah.
And it's held in some repository. Are you aware of this? There's a repository in some secret location.
Yeah. You'll have one of Elvin Jones's, one of Ringo's, one of Bonzo's. I mean, he'll have something, a Baby Dodds drum kit. He'll have everything. He'll have the lot.
Do you envy this collection?
No, because my wife and I love each other, and I don't want to put a spanner in that particular works.
I think of you as having three aspects to your life. Mm-hmm. So comedy, pub landlord, drums, and then clearly an extreme, concentrated obsession with the Second World War.
Yes,
At which point I say you have a new book out. Well, why don't you describe it?
It's Command, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War is the title and subtitle. And the idea is, I didn't want to write about any battles much, because that's difficult and it's been done. And I didn't want to do chaps on maps book with arrows and things. And I didn't really want too many statistics in it, although there are some. But it's 10 people, starting with generals and then working sort of the way down the tree, 10 people involved in the Allied armies and how they tackled the issue of how to win. Because, of course, the thing is that the first 3.5 years of the Second World War...
It was mostly losing.
It's losing and losing complete routs and chaos and ignominy and proper defeat. And they flip it, you know, which is an extraordinary thing.
We'll come back to that. I'm intrigued as to where this fascination comes from. You've referred to it at one point as culturally magnetic, the war.
Yes, yeah. The main driver is my father, who was a soldier he did his national service and then stayed in the TA for a long time. And he was a paratrooper and an engineer, and he was really into it. Most of his officers had fought in the Second World War. So he was interested in it from that point of view because he knew these people, he knew their stories, knew their experiences. And then his father had been was a diplomat post-war. And we touched on him earlier. He was a diplomat post-war, but during the war was SOE Bletchley Park adjacent.
Right.
He was in a thing called the Political Warfare Establishment.
Special Operations Executive, SOE.
Right, yeah.
He's a spook.
He was a spook, and definitely was.
Right.
Various moments where he crops up as part of Harold Macmillan's political mission, so he's part of his sort of advisory team. So he shows up in Italy, he shows up in Greece. When Churchill went to Greece and tried to install Damaskinos as a regent, my grandfather was there, there's no doubt about that. He told his stories of driving in the armoured car through Athens with bullets pinging off the armoured car, all that sort of stuff. So there's that. And then the other side of it is my mother's father was killed in the fighting outside Dunkirk, in a place called Hazebrouck. She never knew her father. And then my grandmother, her mother's brother, was killed in Burma. So the absolute in 1944. So the elephant in the room was
the war.
The war and the loss and the cost.
Jeremy Paxman, and I think Robert Harris as well, who both said this thing. They felt they were lesser because they'd not participated in the Second World War. Do you relate to that?
No, I think that's inestimably silly.
Good. I've always worried about it. I've looked and gone, you feel like you should have been in a war, and if you weren't in a war, you're not a real...
The reason in the end it's bananas, I think, is because character has nothing to do with it. Everything I've read about the Second World War is random fate, chance, chaos, who's going to die and who's going to live, but bear no relation to anything that you do, or you might do, or you might want to do or achieve. It's just the sheer difference between life and death is there isn't any. A point when the bullets start flying, shells start landing. So the idea that somehow I'd love to have endured that test, well, I may not have got through it. So I just think it's a crazy thing to think, and also sort of kind of a luxurious.
isn't it?
It's a luxury opinion, you know, because we have the luxury of not having to deal with that. Thank God. Thank God we live in that luxury.
You have a podcast.
Yes.
So remind me the name of your podcast.
We Have Ways of Making You Talk.
And have you broken 300?
Over 500 now, I think. Because even now, we're finding new things to talk about, new ways to look at it.
You've described it as the endlessly unpeeled onion, haven't you?
Yeah. If you start to look at the Second World War in China, even begin to scratch the surface of that, you realise there's an entire thing we know nothing about, and the scale of the devastation, the scale of it all, and then, of course, Chinese attitudes to Western, and particularly American involvement in the war, you can see why maybe the Chinese Communist Party doesn't trust the West. It's right there. It's no, there should be no mystery about it at all, about how they feel about the West. The way people view it in this country is they know it's called the Second World War, but they only know what happened here.
Yeah. Might have a little bit of idea of a bit of Indochina, Burma,
or even what's going on in Europe. You know, like it is literally a global event, yet we tend to think about the Blitz.
The book that you've written has been very well received. Mm. I'm wondering, when you wade into a field like that, which is not, let's say, is not undiscovered.
Yeah.
There are quite a lot of books about military history.
Yeah.
And some very serious people, not saying you're not a serious person, but people with letters after their name and tenure at universities and stuff like that. Did you hesitate or did you think, no, there's a way I can do this, which is
well, the thing is, Jay, I am really great at book pitch meetings, right? If I had to pitch you a book right now, boy, you'd come away thinking,
I've got to publish that book.
Let's sort the advance out right now. This is red hot. And then I'd go home and go, oh, Christ, what have I done? This is a mountain of work. I can't do this. That's sort of what happened. And once I was into writing it, part of the main issue was to discover a prose style, because I've written 5-6 comedy books now, and those I can do. And also you have a different relationship with your editor on a funny book. The editor will go, well, I don't think that bit's funny, and I'll say, well, I do, so it's staying in.
You start with a reference to Spike Milligan, who may not have planned to do so, but ended up writing one of the earliest and best social histories of the war.
Yeah, yeah. His books are fantastic.
They are very, very funny in places, but they are also very, very moving and tell an extraordinary story of the war. That's 5 volumes?
It's 5 or 6 volumes, yeah. Because there's piecework when he comes back to London and starts to turn into a comedian.
It starts with Hitler, My Part in His Downfall, which is absolutely brilliant. I think I read 5 of them in 3 days as a kid. Just adored them. And you start with him right at the beginning, and it's almost like you've decided to find a door through which people can accept a comedian writing a book.
It's entirely deliberate. You know, and I think there's a quote, and I say, well, if you want the truth, go to a comedian. Start the book, because I sort of thought, well, you know, we are allowed a view on this. But I thought Spike would be the right place to start to sort of say, you know, I am a comedian, but here's a comedian who offers us real value on the subject. Because those memoirs are amazing about what it's like being a soldier, which, after all, is the sort of... The extraordinary thing about the Second World War is blokes who wanted to play the trumpet in Penge suddenly had to become artillerymen.
And still play the trumpet. Still play the trumpet. El Alamein.
Exactly.
Is there a part of you that, having had a career in comedy, which is about making people laugh, and often through the surreal and ridiculous...
Yeah.
Wanted to prove your inherent seriousness?
Absolutely not, no. I don't want to play Hamlet or any of that comedian stuff.
Don't think it's going to happen, Mac. But...
No, it's far too late for that. Well, they didn't Ian McKellen playing recently. I mean, maybe there's a...
Yeah, but he had quite a good form.
Harsh but fair. I mean, there's no great desire to be taken seriously. On the other hand, we should be allowed to do more than one thing.
Yeah.
I don't see why I shouldn't write a history book. If I've done, you know, done the research and thought properly about it, I don't see why I shouldn't. But it's not born of a desire to get anyone to take me seriously, because it's far too late for that in lots of ways. And anyway, with comedy, the secret, I always think the sort of key to it is to take it seriously, but not yourself. I mean, the really hard thing with a book, you have to finish it.
Yes, you have to let it go.
Yeah. It's not like a stand-up show where you never quite finish it.
It keeps changing. The show you might see at the beginning of a 2-year tour is very different.
Very different, yeah. And you're also, you know, if this bit doesn't work tonight, I'll change it around for tomorrow. Whereas the book, you have to go, yes, that is the finished version, and I stand by that. And that's the bit I find hardest of all. I found really like sort of almost repulsive.
Is there any meeting point for the pub landlord and Al Murray, the military historian? Because Gav would surely have an opinion.
Well, he thinks, I mean, the pub landlord does believe that we won the Second World War on our own, no help from no one else. One foot on the floor, one hand behind our back, like a trick shot. He really does believe that. So, you know, I have a more nuanced view, shall we say? Yeah, but they're sort of... That in the character and what I'm interested in, they're related, because what he's doing is using history to tell a story that suits him, and I'm interested in finding out what really is the story. Because the story of the Second World War, the sort of received view, who wouldn't rather be the plucky? I'd rather be the plucky underdog. I'd rather that we were the few, you know, than an imperial war machine that takes 2 years to wake up, and once it's sort of fully engaged, crushes all before it, which is...
Whereas Gav...
Yeah, exactly.
Probably quite keen on the imperial view.
Well, the pub landlord can't make up his mind, so he likes the idea that we're sort of almighty, but he also likes the idea it was...
The plucky,
you know, the Cockneys win the Second World War sort of thing.
You know, there is no reason for a comedy creation to be in any way consistent on this.
No. And, you know, if there's a joke in it, I'll take it, is the way it works with the pub landlord.
Well, listen, Al, thank you for taking the time. There is dessert if we want it, but for now I'm going to say, I know there's creme caramel on there. Al Murray, thank you very much for letting me take you out to lunch.
Oh, no, it's been such a pleasure, Jay. Any time...
Any time.
Any vacancy. Especially, I've always wanted to eat here, so this has been a real treat. Thank you.
What a splendid way to spend a rainy weekday on a boat eating top seafood. Thank you so much to Al Murray and to the wonderful people at the London Shell Company. We dined on the Grand Duchess, which is the static boat in Paddington Basin in London. Al's new book is called Command, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War, and is out now. And if you love this show, do please follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share this with friends, Romans, countrymen, and maybe comment, give us 5 stars, because it makes us feel better about ourselves. Out to Lunch is a Something Else and Jay Rayner production. The music was written, arranged and performed by me, Jay Rayner, and Robert Rickenberg. The recording engineer was Gulliver Tickle and the mix engineer, Josh Gibbs. Assistant producers, Ronya Das and Bethany Hocken. Selena Ream is the producer and the executive producer is Ollie Wilson. Next time, it's actor and writer Mira Sayal. You've been asked about things you'd like still to do. Cleopatra. You'd make a bloody good Cleopatra.
You think so? Get off me barge.
Get off me barge.
Whose asp is this?